This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. On and off for the past 2 months, America has been glued to its TV sets watching the aftermath of a hideous crime unfold, the murder of Nicole Simpson and Ronald Goldman. It would have been hard for a novelist or a screenwriter to dream up a scenario as dramatic and riveting as the one real life has presented, and the media has heightened. The intersection of crime, criminality, truth, and fiction was explored in a panel discussion called Cops and Writers, Crime and Punishment in Literature and Real Life. It was presented this spring by the Penn American Center and the New York Review of Books at New York University. Today on Fresh Air, we're bringing you highlights from that gathering. The panelists included former New York City Police Commissioner Richard J. Condon, former New York City homicide detective Michael Sheehan, who's now an investigative reporter for Fox News, and New York State Supreme Court Judge Edwin Torres, who's also the author of three books, including Carlito's Way and After Hours. Also on the panel were writers Walter Mosley, Joyce Carol Oates, Linda Wolfe, and Evan Hunter, also known as Ed McBain. The moderator for the group was newspaper columnist Murray Kempton, who asked the panelists how they got interested in crime and criminality. We start with Mike Sheehan's response.
The first things that got me interested in police work was as a young boy sitting on a stoop up in Spanish Harlem. And we'd chip in and we'd buy, I think, the Daily Mirror, not to get into the newspapers. I heed your warning. But you get the Daily Mirror, let's say. It's some outrageous headline. Actually looks kind of tame in light of what we see today in our papers. But you'd have an outrageous headline about a terrible homicide somewhere in the city. And the fascination among the guys on that stoop was, how in God's name are they ever going to find this guy? This is a city of 8 million people. Naked City tells us this every night. You know, there's 8 million stories. Where are they going to get this guy? You know, where are they going to start? And I think that's what the beginning of a lot of our writers probably is the same. I mean, it's a fascination with the underbelly of the city, the fascination with the bizarre. What makes somebody do it? And then what drives a detective and the cops? How do they find this guy in a city of 8 million people? And the fascinating thing, for me at least, with 3 days after you'd see this terrible headline, there'd be another picture on all the front pages of two members of what we used to call the Beef Trust, two big beefy detectives with cigars, and they'd be dragging a guy into the station house in cuffs. How did they get this guy? Where did they get him? And it was a fascination that lasted. I was a foot patrolman in Harlem, radio car. I worked in narcotics. I was an undercover. I was lucky enough to go into the detective bureau and eventually homicide. And I found out for myself.
Thank you very much. Linda?
Yes, I wanted to say that I write true crime, but I came to it through fiction. And I just want to say a little bit about that. In the 60s, early 60s, I was writing fiction and publishing in literary magazines. And I was very dissatisfied with my short stories because I felt that they didn't have an engine. I hadn't had enough life experience. Nothing really had happened to me. I was looking inside myself, and the stories that I wrote were not real enough somehow. And so I started clipping stories out of the newspapers, and I used to save these clippings, which I still have, that are sort of moldering in this drawer of mine. Mysterious death in Topeka, Kansas. This is a very good one, by the way, if there's any writer out there. It was a 1962 killing of a woman who was a patient at the Menninger Clinic, and they never found her killer. And I have a whole bunch of these things. And finally, after a while, I thought maybe I'll switch and try and write about these real things. It took a long time, because at that point in the early 60s, Tom Wolfe, who's no relation of mine, I'm sorry to say, but has said that the fiction writers were the true creative people, and journalists were looked upon as a kind of lesser creature. They were merely, I think he calls them, slag diggers. And they just went out and dug and brought back facts. But you, to be really a creative person, you had to be writing fiction. Now, as we all know, this has changed in the last 20 years. There's been a burst of wonderful journalism, I guess starting with Capote, and particularly in the area of crime, and particularly when the crime writer tries to use the tools of fiction and to think the way a fiction writer does, to get inside the mind of the criminal or the victim.
Mr. Hunter.
I'm not even sure I'm that fascinated with crime. When I first began writing, the markets opened to me as a young writer were the pulp magazines. I don't know if you're all familiar with those. They were about the size of this pad, and the covers, they were printed on this very grainy, yellowish paper that had leaves and twigs floating in it, so which is why they were called pulp, because it was pulp wood that they made it from. And the covers were usually printed in the primary colors, which are red, yellow, and blue. And usually showed a woman in jeopardy of, if it were a science fiction pulp, she was usually being threatened by a bug-eyed monster of some sort. And a detective pulp was usually an Oriental for some reason threatening her. And they were all very scantily clad, except in the romance pulps, where there was just usually a woman with a horse on the cover. But the four major categories were detective, science fiction, Western, and romance. And I was born and raised in New York. I'd never been on a horse in my life. The romance market was mostly written by women writers. In college, the science I took was geology. And it seemed easy to write about crime. It just seemed easier, and they paid a quarter of a cent a word for these stories. And if you use a lot of ands and thes, you could make a fortune. I think what interests me more than crime, and I'll explain this in a moment where I'm going, is change. And I think that since I've written both straight novels and crime novels, I tried to figure out what is the difference between the two. Because I feel that any good novel should be about change, something that happens to a character that causes some sort of epiphany, whether the change is insight or recognition or even the realization that the character will never change. That in itself is change of a sort. But we read the straight novel and get involved in these events, and we wait for the change that will come in the character. In the crime novel, on the other hand, the change comes at the very beginning of the novel. There is a murder. There is an aberration in the orderly flow of events, a change. And the hero or heroine comes in and tries to set that change, tries to reverse that change, tries to create order where the change has made chaos. So we stay with the crime novel where the change has already occurred, only to make certain that it will be righted again. Things will be okay at the end. We will be able to pull the covers under our noses and sleep the sleep of babes. I think that people are fascinated with crime novels because they're so terrified themselves of becoming victims. The crime novel assures them that the people who are out there committing the crimes will be brought to justice, will be apprehended, will be brought before a court, will be found guilty, and will be sent to prison. And it gives us a sense of security. It takes us away from the real crime that's in the street everywhere around us, and makes us feel safe, makes us feel that this body of laws we have created over centuries and centuries and centuries to protect ourselves from each other and also from ourselves, this body of law works. That's why we read the crime novel, I think.
That was writer Evan Hunter, a.k.a. Ed McBain, speaking at a panel discussion on crime and punishment in literature and real life. It was presented by the international writers' organization PEN and the New York Review of Books on April 18th at New York University. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're back listening to a panel discussion recorded this spring about crime, police work, and writing about crime. We'll hear from Linda Wolf, Evan Hunter, and Joyce Carol Oates, who tells us how crime affected her family and her work. First, a discussion about whether or not cops become callous to criminals and how that might affect the quality of their work. Mike Sheehan, a TV reporter and former homicide detective, offers these thoughts.
Any detective worth his salt in this country, who has a theory and locks himself into the theory. Mm-hmm. And then let's say the guy gets transferred or he retires, whatever. The next detective who comes in now, let's say the case is still open, he picks up that case, which should read, by the way, like a novel. It should read that way. The worst thing that I've ever seen among the police is like the above exited, the perpetrator. Look. You try to read that, especially on a stand, read somebody else's work to a jury who wants, they're there to be entertained. They wanna know. That's true. They wanna know exactly what happened. And you're giving them all of this, and therefore, and the undersigned, I always wrote in the first person. I had some bosses that didn't care for that, but today, myself and Ed Torres went into 117 East 119th Street. And we spoke to Maggie Gonzalez on the first floor. She told us her son wasn't home, but that he left his gun in the top drawer. And Papo borrowed it last night. And if you read like that, I think you come across better. It's more credible. But now, getting back to locking himself in, when you pick up that case folder, if everything you read was created, every piece of paper was created by that detective who says that this guy, I'm positive this guy did it, and this is why he did it, et cetera, et cetera. The crust, as we spoke about before, becomes really apparent. He gets sucked into this, and you're going off on a totally wrong tangent. You might have a total, a guy that no one ever even looked at is the suspect.
So the initial cop's view of it will carry down to the subsequent cops investigating?
I'm talking about the initial investigator. Let's say if you have one investigator who puts a lot of his time into a case, the worst thing that you can do as an investigator is to get locked in. You must keep an open mind, as the judge
says. But will
his
view prevail down the line?
Hopefully not, if he's going to be one of those guys who locks himself in.
Unless he's right.
That's true, Chris.
Does anyone, you all are doing so much better than I am. Do you have anything to say? I would like to find out about law officers getting callous, not because it means they make mistakes, but because it means they've lost their humanity, which seems to me terribly important to a law officer. Not that you ever lost yours, Judge. But,
God forbid.
How about yours?
Mine?
Yours is fine. I was asking Mike about his, because he's now in television. And
oh, okay.
It really breeds it.
Now I've turned callous.
Right.
Now I'll learn how to tell a story in 2 minutes. That's callous. especially for an Irishman.
Right.
No, but
impossible.
It is impossible. I've taken over 1,000 homicide confessions, and the callous guy is not going to get that confession. Contrary to all this popular belief, the rubber hose and all that stuff, and you better tell us, or that doesn't work. Maybe the criminal today is too well educated. I don't know. They certainly know their rights. And although many of them waive their right to an attorney, they have this impulse to speak, to tell their story, which leads them down the path to the confession. And in many cases, thank God, from a police point of view, because there was no physical evidence, et cetera, the case. And the Chambers case is a prime example. Without that confession, I doubt whether he'd be upstate today,
Someone told me that there are more confessions now than there were before Miranda.
That's amazing.
Well, I wouldn't doubt it. And one of the greatest tools, the videotape, today is probably the greatest tool for law enforcement. But it's an amazing thing. Even you'd think that they would have these discussion groups in prison. Say like, hey, did you talk to the cops? Yeah. Stupid move, huh?
Dumb.
You know. But they don't do that. They don't do that. And it really is, it's an amazing phenomenon.
Mike, I've been wondering about that. I've never understood how when you tell the guard, you know, you start reading his rights, that he then doesn't clam up. What is the thing that...
A lot of them think that they can rationalize. In Robert Chambers' case, he thought he was smarter than every detective there.
If I may interject. Sure. There's also, from my experience in Homicide Bureau, there's also the purging catharsis factor. When you apprehend an individual fresh on the heels of this, like, you know, he stabbed, like I've had, you know, 70 stab wounds, there's a period there, I think Michael will corroborate this, maybe 24 hours when they want to talk about it. They want to get it off their chest,
yeah,
literally.
It's the Raskolnikov.
Exactly.
Well, now, we have here four writers who have examined the criminal line and known criminal types over a long period of interest. Does each of you have something, some discovery about what makes criminals that has struck you as particularly useful?
Well, while my fellow panelist was speaking, I was thinking how in my own lifetime, I haven't really known any criminals, but I've known so many victims. And I guess it's sort of a macho thing to identify with the perpetrator, who tends to often be male. And I was surprised at what Walter said, though I'm sure he's correct, that most victims of violence are actually men. We think of women and children being abused and battered, raped, and murdered in this country in alarming degrees. And I don't have the statistics at my fingertips, you know, to quote them, but they really are astounding. The degree of violence perpetrated against women and against children. Anyway, my background is sort of working class or maybe below working class. I come from upstate New York in a very rural community. And this is some time ago. I mean, I won't embarrass myself by saying how many decades ago. But there was a good deal of crime going on of a domestic violence type. And it's possible, or even quite probable, that these crimes were not so defined then, and they were not reported to any police. But I lived in a world where men worked in factories, and or they were unemployed or on strike, but never in control of their lives as earners or breadwinners of a family. I mean, they might have to go out on strike or they might just be laid off. And so it was a world in which the economy was very precarious, and the men did a lot of drinking, both in my own family and in our neighbors and so forth. And a man would get drunk and he would go after his family. We would hear screams from next door. My father would go next door and try to help the children or the wife who was being threatened with a butcher knife. He would himself being threatened by being punched, you know. None of this, I think, was ever reported to the police. And at the time, nobody would have said the man who got drunk and beat up his children and wife was a criminal. But yet today we would say that this is a crime and he would be, I hope he would be reported. So the statistics today are in, you know, they're different from what they used to be. And at the very beginning of my own life, even before I was born, my life was determined by an act of murder. My grandfather was murdered, and because of that, my mother, who was the youngest of about nine children in a very poor farm family, had to be given away. I'm not telling any secrets. I've actually written about this, but I've written about it in the context of language. I feel I'm blushing because I'm speaking kind of awkwardly and falteringly now, and it's not a family secret. But my whole life and my mother's life and everything subsequent to that was really deflected by an act of murder. But nobody would ever talk about it in my family. I learned about it when I was an adult. It's just that we always had the consequences of it. And we lived in a world in which I went to one-room schoolhouse, and as I say, it was a very impoverished part of the world. And there were definitely acts of what we call sexual harassment would have been a luxury in that world. The things that went on, and we would hear about acts of incest that these boys would be boasting that they had forced their younger sisters into doing. So as I said earlier, my identification, it's a very involuntary sympathy, is with the victims. But I would like to make the victims individuals and show that they have their own personalities and their anger and integrity. They're not flat, two-dimensional cartoon figures who are just sort of on the floor, you know, and of no interest, while the perpetrators are these macho characters that Norman Mailer would be infatuated with. I don't find the Jack Abbotts of the world so mesmerizing, and I read a lot about serial killers, a lot more than I needed to read, I think. I mean, I don't find them fascinating. I think many of their victims who've survived have been extraordinarily courageous. And I think this is one thing that possibly women writers and maybe other you know, men as well, but it's a focus less on crime and the criminal as a man of action, less on that than on the victims who are human too.
In a good mystery novel, really finding out what the victim was all about is what leads to uncovering mm-hmm. the murderer. Absolutely. So that the very process, the unfolding of a mystery novel, is learning all about the victim. Mm.
That was Joyce Carol Oates and Evan Hunter, a.k.a. Ed McBain, two of the panelists in a discussion hosted by the International Writers Organization, PEN, and the New York Review of Books recorded this spring. We'll be presenting more highlights in the second half of our show. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We're back with taped highlights from a panel discussion, Cops and Writers, Crime and Punishment in Literature and Real Life. The event was presented by the PEN American Center and the New York Review of Books on April 18th at New York University. This segment leads off with mystery writer Walter Mosley talking about what might lead someone to commit a crime and the nature of crime itself.
Maybe I'll be kind of crusty on this. I have two answers to what creates a criminal. I don't really answer it, and they're not quite together. But the first one is, as a writer, I just approach the question formally. A crime occurs when my actions, according to my sense of right and wrong, disagrees with yours. That's my child, that's my money, because I earned it, because I can take it, because I need it more than you do, because I can't help myself, because it pleases me to see my power over you. It is, and it's very simple, it's very formal. You know, the idea of trying to come into a moral or ethical understanding as a writer seems useless to me, because it disintegrates writing. The second, I think of Bill Sykes, you know, and Charles Dickens, Bill Sykes, because I remember it was one of the best things. I love Dickens. And one of the best, when he describes, you know, rather than going through this long social thing about Sykes, he says, Sykes' first memory was wandering down a road, and he was hungry and looking for something to steal. He didn't remember his parents. He didn't remember his fluffy rabbit doll. He remembered desperation and the conviction to survive, period. He was not a nice man. Crime is relative to the society in which you find yourself. If you and your best friend are living in a cold water flat and you're hungry, the miraculous appearance of a 5-pound ham won't be questioned, at least not morally or ethically. Maybe you ask about it to see where you can get another 5-pound ham. Crime, I think, is always a betrayal. And it's a betrayal in this sense, it bites the hand that feeds you. You know, if it's not doing that, it's not wrong, at least by the people who you're surrounded by. Somebody else might think it's wrong, but that's them. I, on the other hand, don't think it's wrong. Well, yeah, he killed him, right? Well, he should have killed him. Yeah, he messed around with his wife, he should have killed him, right? You know, and you have this thing, and you understand it when people can accept people who they know who are doing things that other people define as crimes. I don't define it as a crime, so why? Listen, that's what I would do. And this is just the way that I understand the making of a criminal. It's kind of like when all of a sudden you're displaced in another world. You find yourself in Indiana, for instance. And, you know, so, anyway.
I think we really get to the heart of the matter here when we're talking about the nature of crime and the so-called criminal mind. And I think that this is part of the reason I choose in half of my creative life to write about crime and criminals. But part of trying to understand why people do these strange things, why someone will go into a mom and pop grocery store with a gun in his fist, knowing there's $50 in the cash register that he may get, and knowing equally well that he's looking at 20 years in prison. That's what he's looking at down the line if he gets caught. I don't know why he would do that. I don't know why, if someone is having trouble with his wife and feels the marriage isn't working, why he wouldn't consider separation or divorce. Why he would think, I think I'll kill her.
He's still emotionally involved.
Well, the answer is that there's no sense of tomorrow, I think, in people who commit crimes like that. They're acting impulsively, and they're not organized in the same way that you and I are. They're not thinking about what is the next step. They're reacting to the situation.
I remember years and years ago, they used to have lineups in New York City, not for purposes of identification the way we have them now, but to acquaint the working detectives in each precinct with the people who were committing felonies in this city. And I remember this was so shocking to me. They brought out this one woman, and the chief of detectives was talking to her, and he said, well, what happened there? What happened with, do you know that your husband is very seriously injured? And she said, yes. And he said, well, can you tell us what happened? And she was a very thin, frail looking woman, and she said, I was watching television, and he came in and turned the channel. She said, and I went into the bathroom, and I spied a hatchet, and I brought it back in and hit him with it. And he said, do you know how many times you hit him? He said, yes, I hit him, I don't know, a lot of times. He said, you hit him 37 times, Virginia. Her name was Virginia. I'll never, you hit him 37 times. He said, do you know her condition? She said, no, I don't. He said, he's dead. So this, to her, was a perfectly reasonable solution for this man.
Yes.
Having turned the channel, in that case, here's a hatchet, I might as well kill him.
Evan.
Evan,
I had occasion to meet a murderer who had murdered his wife, let's not leave this with the woman taking the axe. This fellow had murdered his wife, and his reason, as he explained it, was that she'd asked him to go out and buy a bottle of milk when he'd come home from looking for work. He was unemployed. He'd been out looking for work all day. The baby was screaming. He came home, and it was just too much. You know, that asking him to go for the bottle of milk was just too much, and he got the kitchen knife and stabbed her. So this is what I mean about the suddenness. They're not considering the connection between...
But why is it a viable solution? Is it in the nature of the beast?
Getting rid of the irritation.
Oh, Evan, excuse me. These are mentally unbalanced people. I mean, these are not college professors. I'm very good friends with a public defender, and she had worked in Trenton for many years. And my friend, this public defender, she said that virtually all her clients are mentally disturbed people. And you're projecting yourself in it. You're saying, why doesn't this man go and get Rael Felder's, a divorce attorney, or someone, you know, to help him with his divorce? No, they don't. Linda said they don't think. There's no concept of the future, and they are just governed by
But
their
then insanity
emotion.
Would be a reasonable defense in any murder, no?
They're disturbed, but they're not schizophrenic.
Well, insane and disturbed are different.
I mean, he must have crossed her once before.
Many times.
Right, yeah.
I mean, her will could not have commanded that household. I mean, that's why you have novels.
We're listening to a discussion recorded this spring at New York University about crime, criminality, and writing. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with highlights from Cops and Writers, Crime and Punishment in Literature and Real Life. Here's New York State Supreme Court Judge Edwin Torres, who's also a novelist.
There is no field of human endeavor that provides as much grist for the literary mill as crime. I mean, I've written three novels, and I don't think I've ever coined out of whole cloth a line of dialogue. Somebody has said something that I've written somewhere, And you could not duplicate. Just in an everyday course of events in a courtroom, you hear exchanges and colloquies which are beyond. I remember when I sentenced Nookie Sweeper in a murder case. He said, well, you have anything to say in mitigation? He said, well, I had to do what I had to do. Right. And I said to him, okay, Nookie, now I got to do what I got to do, 20 to 5 to life. You know, I mean, you have these exchanges. We went through this thing. I mean, you couldn't invent these things. I mean, but apropos, I'll give you an example, the Cliff Fishman that she alluded to. Here's a guy, this is the complexity, inexplicability, if there's such a word, of the criminal mind. Here's a guy who was a real estate developer, a very polished gentleman with a fine apartment in Jersey and in the Palisades and whatnot, and he goes to the South Bronx. He has to extinguish his beautiful, charming wife, who is a school teacher. She teaches at Trinity, and she's a very close friend of the renowned district attorney Linda Fasting, because they went to school together. And he's got to rub her out, he's got to whack her out, because she wants to divorce him, and he doesn't want to pay for this. So he goes to the South Bronx, and he retains the most bedraggled crew of Puerto Rican hitmen you've ever seen. And they come down to whack Mrs. Fishman out, and they bring three, as they call them, three chicks with them as sightseers, as tourists. And they converge, because he's giving them explicit instructions how to follow the car from Jersey across to GW, get off over here at 72nd, where she gets off. She puts it in the garage, and then she walks to Trinity in the West 90s. So then, of course, he jumps on a plane, he flies to Florida, being Florida by the time they take the old lady out. Meanwhile, the first day they lose her on the GW bridge the first day. Second day, they lose her in the garage. And the third day, they lose her en route to the school. So by this time, Fishman's back in town, and they still haven't rubbed the wife out. So then they decide to shoot her in front of the school. They're waiting for her. She's got a styrofoam cup of coffee in her hand, and she's getting into the school. She's got her earrings on her watch. So the first guy, this first shooter, if you want to call it, jumps out of the car with the automatic. He starts blasting away. It knocks the watch off her wrist, deflects off her scalp, and all the rest of the bullets miss her. Okay, she has the presence of mind, which even Mike wouldn't have under the circumstances. She, as she related, she bent down after they fled in the car and picked up all of the cartridges from the automatic. She said there might be evidence later on in the case. Remember that? And I'm listening to this, and I say, this, you couldn't make this up in a month of... Okay, am I right or am I exaggerating?
Right, and then the story of their relationship, you couldn't possibly make. You couldn't make this up. Do you remember that he had picked her up in Zabar's? They were standing on the line, and he noticed this charming young woman. She was considerably younger than he was, and he started talking to her and telling her that he was buying lox and bagels to have a brunch with his children, and would she care to come? And she said, "Well, I don't normally have anything to do with strangers," but he said, "But I'm having my three children," which is how this woman came to become involved with this crazed murderer, and
attempted murderer.
Excuse me.
But he was scouring the streets of the South Bronx.
Then he wrote poetry, and she was an English teacher.
Attempted.
And he began
poetry.
Writing poetry.
We've been listening to a discussion recorded this spring at New York University. Cops and Writers, Crime and Punishment in Literature and Real Life was presented by the Pan American Center and the New York Review of Books. The panelists were Richard J. Condon, Evan Hunter, a.k.a. Ed McBain, Walter Mosley, Joyce Carol Oates, Michael Sheehan, Edwin Torres, and Linda Wolf. Murray Kempton was the moderator. Many thanks to Pamela Pierce from Penn. Fresh Air's presentation was produced by Naomi Person with Danny Miller, Nancy Greenlease, Kathy Wolf, and Fred Landrell. This is Fresh Air.